Hello, I'm Mark. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you all with us here. It's time for our weekly look at Soundbites. Soundbites, of course, being our weekly look at the food system and farming and the future of farming in our world. And it's good to have you all with us. We are going to talk about the Transatlantic and Trans-Pacific Trade and Investment Partnership, things most of us haven't heard about, but we will and need to talk about it. The Nutrient Trading Program, that's something else that most of us haven't heard about, but we need to and we will coming up later in this hour. And then a conversation with our commentator, Tom Horton, and Bill Nelson about their month-long journey to the secret parts of the Eastern Shore. All that coming up. Let me introduce our guest here, Simon Lester, trade policy analyst at the Herbert Steele Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Simon, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Catherine Paul, Associate Director of the Organic Consumers Association. Catherine, welcome. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
So let's talk about this. Catherine, we can begin with you. Just there are these two agreements that are going to take place, it appears, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TTIP and TTIP, I guess, or whatever the acronyms are going to be. they're upon us. So I'd like to get both of your analysis very quickly about what you think these trade agreements mean, because many people looking at NAFTA and other trade agreements that have taken place over the last 20 years, those who do know about these, even if they don't know all the facts inside of them, are nervous about them because of what they assume happened with these others. Catherine?
Yes. And consumers should be nervous about these trade agreements. Actually, they should be more than nervous. Speaking just in the context of food safety, our biggest concern as a representative of consumers, advocating on behalf of consumers, is that both of these agreements would force participating countries to harmonize food safety standards. And what that means is that all of the countries that sign on to the trade agreements would be forced to abide by the lowest common denominator of all the participating governments. And that simply means that, if the U.S. has certain food safety regulations governing, say, for instance, seafood, and we sign on to the agreement and other countries sign on and just take, for example, Vietnam also signs on to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and they have lower standards for seafood, lower safety standards. We're required to allow them to export that seafood into our country and abide. We have to abide by their standards, not the U.S. standards, assuming that both countries sign on to the agreement. So, it really weakens food safety regulations in all countries.
So I'm going to probe that a little bit more deeply. But Simon Lester, let me get your take on these two agreements coming up.
Well, I think the core of all of these trade agreements is the idea that we want to find a way to reduce protectionism on a global basis. And I think there are benefits to producers in terms of efficiency and to consumers in terms of getting access to more products at lower prices. I think, to me, that's the core reason that we engage in these trade agreements. Now, there are some provisions that go beyond the idea of reducing protectionism. And I do actually share some of the concerns that Catherine has for a few of these provisions. But as a general matter, I don't think there is much of a threat to strong or high U.S. food safety standards. I think the idea of harmonization is something that some agricultural interests push. I don't think they're going to get very far with it. I think that the most we would see in either of these agreements is some kind of limited, recognition of other country standards for particular products, not necessarily for food safety. I'm thinking more of, for automobile safety. I think the impact on domestic food safety regulations is actually pretty limited. I think that we can still apply our high standards to imports. We just have to do it in a way that's not protectionist. We can apply a strict standard. It just has to be applied equally to both domestic products and foreign products. And that can definitely get tricky when you get into specific cases. And But I think as a general matter, we can do this away. We can regulate in a way that is consistent with these international trade agreements.
Now, one of the things that when I look at these agreements and see what the history of these things are, I'm curious what, from your perspective, Catherine and Simon, Catherine starting, why people should care about this? I mean, people listening to this all throughout the Eastern Shore of Maryland, across the state of Maryland right now, people who are involved in agriculture, people who are involved in a food industry. What's the concern from your perspective? Why should people even care about what we're talking about here?
Because of food safety.
But what do you mean by that? How would food safety be? How would the integrity of our food safety, that some people question anyway in America at the moment, be affected by
exactly.
this? You know, tell me, what does that mean? Food safety.
Food safety regulations aren't what some would say they ought to be to begin with. But again, the example I gave. I mean, if our country and other countries sign on to this agreement, we have to abide by the lowest common denominator standards. So what's the point of having high standards for food safety if those standards are basically wiped out under these agreements and we allow imports of food under standards that are lower than we've set for our own country? And the one of our biggest concerns here is the fact that these trade agreements are being negotiated without input from Congress, without input from the public, and not only without input, but without knowledge. I mean, the drafts of these negotiations are kept secret, and what we know is only known because there have been leaks. Who is allowed to do this? Who's doing the negotiating? Who's in on it? Who are the consultants to the U.S. trade representative? Corporations, 600 corporations. And I think we can all agree that corporations are more concerned about their bottom line, about profits, than they are about public health or public safety. I mean, that's... So it's a huge concern that they are in on this, that they're allowed to see the text, the negotiations, and the public in Congress are not. And yes, I agree with Simon that the whole purpose of this is to break down barriers to trade.
So
barriers to trade are restrictions, and restrictions exist usually for a reason.
So now Simon Lester, as someone who works at the Cato Institute, which is a place that believes deeply in the free market, and a lot of our participants and listeners are in this on Soundbites are many in rural areas, and many who are farmers have strong libertarian principles. Who listen to this program, principals from all over, but they do especially in the farming community. And when you have something where the president administration is kind of pushing these agreements through Congress without really giving lawmakers a chance to draft texts, to debate it at all, when it actually gives multinational corporations the right to sue our government and other governments for loss of any anticipated future profits, isn't this something that people who believe in the free market as you do be concerned about?
Well, I think to a great extent what these trade agreements do is promote the free market. And I think that's what free trade at its core, at least the core that I see, does, because it allows more competition. And it's not just competition within your territory, it's competition worldwide. So that's just creating a bigger market. And I see that as very positive, and I think it's good for consumers. And those who believe in the free market should support it. That's not to say it won't have an impact that some people might not like. I mean, if there are domestic industries that suddenly have to compete with foreign companies, I mean, I can understand why they're concerned about it. I would just say, on the whole, we as a country, as a society, are better off with this competition. The benefits outweigh the costs to it. In terms of the secrecy issue, I mean, sure, I would love to see more transparency here. I'd love to see more debate. I mean, I have specific criticisms of these agreements, and I'd like to get them out there, and I try to get them out there. At the same time, I do think there is a lot of information out there. We know we have a pretty good sense of what's going to be in these agreements because we've seen the past agreements. So to me, the focus should be more on, you know, what's in these agreements? Do we like it or do we not like it? And, you know, I think, you know, if Catherine and I sat down, we'd probably find, you know, some areas of agreement and some areas of disagreement. So I'm happy to have more of a debate. I do think there is, you know, a fair amount of debate already. And I just want to reiterate, though, that I just, in my view, as I read these agreements, the food safety rules, high food safety standards, are not really undermined by these agreements. The core things that these agreements do are, one, fight protectionism, and I don't see how discriminatory
fight for what
food protectionism.
Protectionism.
So,
I'm sorry.
Right. So,
uh-huh.
So basically, using food safety rules as a disguised way to discriminate against foreign goods, and you know, these agreements prohibit that, and I don't see any problem with that. The other issue is what these agreements sometimes do is require that domestic laws be science-based, and that sounds great in theory. In practice, it's a little difficult sometimes to evaluate whether particular laws are science-based. People don't always agree on the science, and that's where I have some of my own concerns about whether these agreements really work, and that's an area where I think Catherine and I might agree a little bit more. But in general, I don't see much evidence that any rules related to food safety in these agreements will undermine our ability to have high food safety standards.
Catherine, do you all agree there? What are your concerns about what you might have just heard?
I guess where Simon and I do agree, you know, on some points, but I think where we disagree is that this is necessarily good for consumers. I think countries, the U.S. and other countries as well, have a right to establish what they believe to be safe guidelines. And this trade agreement, for instance, if you look at Europe has long had grave concerns about GMOs, genetically modified organisms, biotech crops. And they have strict restrictions on them because that's what the citizens in their countries want. That's what they've demanded. This agreement would basically knock down those restrictions. If the European Union wants to participate, wants to sign on to this, there's a big push for them to have to allow Monsanto's and other biotech companies GMO crops into their countries. I don't think that's protectionism on their part. I think that they've made these determinations that they don't want these crops, they don't want these foods on what they believe to be sound science, and they ought to be able to uphold those restrictions and not be penalized by not being allowed to be part of the trade agreement.
So, I mean, one of the great questions here, we only have a few minutes left in this segment, is that these Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, people would argue would force a kind of lowering of standards across the board. And I guess, how close are we then, Simon Lester, for these to pass Congress now? Where are we?
Well, the transatlantic talks are just starting this week, so we have a long time. I mean, they say they want to finish this by the end of 2014. I don't know if they'll make it. So, yeah, we're just at the initial stages. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is further along, but at the same time, I mean, these talks can linger on for a while, and it really wouldn't surprise me if we never saw a completed agreement here. I mean, you have with the TPP, you have a lot of countries negotiating about a lot of issues, so we're still a little ways off. I could just comment quickly on the Europe and the genetically modified foods issue. I cannot imagine the EU signing on to an agreement where they committed themselves to removing their current restrictions on GMOs. They believe very strongly in this, so I just have a hard time believing that there anything in this agreement would alter EU policy on genetically modified foods. Certainly, they could agree to it, but I can't see it happening. So. There is always the theoretical possibility that these agreements could have an impact on domestic regulation in that way, but I mean, I don't see why they would sign on. They feel strongly about it, and they're going to preserve their ability to regulate GM food strictly.
So I want to thank both of you. This is just the beginning of this. We'll be looking at this a great deal. Have you back for longer sessions with others as well, maybe get some of our congressional representatives involved in these discussions with the two of you and others as we look at these new trade and investment partnerships, transatlantic and transpacific, what they might mean for us, the debates taking place over the next year. I want to thank Simon Lester, trade policy analysts of the Herbert Stifel Center for Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and Catherine Paul, Associate Director of the Organic Consumers Association. Catherine and Simon, thank you both so much for being with us here on Soundbites today.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we're going to look at something also we don't hear much about, which is these nutrient trading programs happening within the state of Maryland. We'll be talking with Scott Edwards, co-director of Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Don't go away here on Soundbites. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, and of course, Soundbites here that you hear here on WEAFM in Baltimore, Maryland at 88.9 FM, and Soundbites that plays, it's also on WSCL and WSDL on the Eastern Shore, Delmarva Public Radio, and welcome to all of our listeners in this continual conversation we have about the future of our food system. We're now about to have a conversation with Scott Edwards, who's co-director of Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. And Scott, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark. Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
We were going to have a rip-roaring debate on nutrient trading within the state of Maryland, but it's not happening because most people don't want to talk about it yet. But you, but
I'm happy to talk about it. I'm not quite sure why anybody would consider it premature. I mean, it's in full swing and.
Scott, if you would, for our listeners, you and I have had this conversation off the air as we were talking about these issues in a meeting, and Describe for our listeners what this nutrient trading program means within a state like Maryland, and how it's transpired and transpiring and what it means from your analysis.
Sure. I think it's useful to have a little bit of a background on the way nutrient pollution, all pollution, but nutrients also were controlled or supposed to be controlled under the Clean Water Act. And the Clean Water Act was enacted 40 years ago because our rivers and our bays and waterways were in crisis. And the law was enacted to force industrial point sources of pollution, factories and wastewater treatment plants, coal-fired power plants, and all these end-of-the-pipe kinds of discharges of pollutants. It was enacted to force them to clean up their discharges to get down to what was the goal of the Clean Water Act was a zero discharge standard, so we could clean up our waterways. And they did that by forcing technology and technological advances on these industries and a permitting system in which each facility was allowed to only discharge the amount of pollution that would come out of the pipe once they installed the best technology available. And that's how we managed to turn many, many, many of our waterways around in this country is through that Clean Water Act, through the technology-driving permitting system of the Clean Water Act. These nutrient trading programs that are coming online right now flip that whole system on its head, and what it says is that these sources of pollution, and we're talking now about not only coal-fired power plants and wastewater treatment plants and other sources of pollution, but things like CAPOs, which are point sources under the Clean Water Act. What this is saying now with nutrient trading is that these facilities will be able to buy their way out of complying with those technological permit standards. And so if you don't want to upgrade your power plant, if you don't want to put in the latest technology, if you don't want to ratchet down your discharges, you can go out and buy some credits somewhere. And the way it's being structured in Maryland and across the country is that the source of those credits is going to be agriculture, because agriculture is a big discharger of nutrients. As everybody in the Bay knows, it's the largest source of nutrient pollution to the Bay. And so the idea is that these facilities will buy credits off of farms who claim that they will reduce their pollutant loads in exchange for creating these credits.
So, well, one of the things that the people who support the trading say, the government of Maryland, let's say, is that, right. that the rising level of pollutants that's in the Chesapeake Bay, nitrogen, phosphorus, that there's not enough public sector money for programs to reduce these pollutants and meet the goals that were set. So the solution is to try to create a public marketplace for trading credits, allowing that to happen. So there'll be trading between point sources like wastewater treatment plants, or there'll be the trading between point and non-point sources, you know, wastewater treatment plants and, let's say, farming operations, or between non-point sources like agriculture and urban stormwater sites and systems. And that's and they're saying because the only way to do this is with an economic incentive, and this is kind of an easy, as they would put it, online system for calculating these credits that they can create, and this is the only way that can they can really make this change happen to protect the Bay.
Right. They want to open up a marketplace.
And, I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry, Scott. Go ahead. Scott, you there? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, we got
you. They want to open up a marketplace for the shifting of credits, and their big argument is economics, that if you open up this marketplace, buying and selling pollution credits, industries can spend their money and purchase credits and drive the reduction in non-points, and as you said, transfer between point sources and other point sources where they can try to save money. So it is an attempt to save money. The question is, though, at what cost? We're entering into a system that has never been shown to be successful in any watershed anywhere at cleaning up our waterways. So it is cheaper to pollute. They're right. It's cheaper to not regulate our sources of pollution and let our waterways get worse. But that's not what our priorities are as a nation. When we passed the Clean Water Act, it was to clean up our waterways. And the Clean Water Act, as written, doesn't say to industries, you have to clean up your discharges no matter what the cost. If you're achieving 95% reduction of your pollution at a wastewater treatment plant or coal-fired power plant, and you can't get that last 5% down because it's going to cost you billions of dollars in technological updates and upgrades, Clean Water Act says you can balance those costs with those last little amounts of pollution that you can't get through, and that becomes part of your permit. The danger here, though, is we've just created a marketplace in which those what industries will now balance is whether they're going to upgrade their technology at something that's even affordable, or they're just going to go out and buy these cheap phantom credits from other sources and non-point sources and farms, which will never be verified.
So it
might be cheaper in the long run for these industries, but it's going to cost the people of Maryland and the people of the United States much more money in terms of polluted water and increases in discharges.
So in the few minutes we have left, one of the things you said to me once I thought it's interesting to point out, we get into next time in a larger debate and discussion, is that how this is going to affect communities of color and poor communities in the state.
Sure. Sure. It is a part of the marketplace. Often when you implement these kinds of market approaches, the people with the fewer resources, communities of color, will be impacted most greatly. This happened in the L.A., Los Angeles air trading programs in the 1990s. They tried to implement all these air pollution trading schemes and had to deal with junk cars and these refineries purchasing credits from junk car dealers and shipping. The same thing we're looking at in the Bay with water pollution, just shifting these things around through a market-based approach. No verification, no accountability. And it's finding that where these factories, these refineries, these coal-fired power plants are purchasing credits in order to increase their pollutant discharges, these types of facilities are located most often in communities of color and in poor communities. And those are the ones who will be impacted the most by the increases in discharges. So trading, pollution trading is a huge environmental justice issue. It happened in L.A. with the air program. They get away with the air program. It will happen with water pollution trading. And folks say, well, it's just nutrients. Well, yeah, nutrients are pollutants, though, and nutrients do have impacts on waterway, and nutrients do have impacts on public health. But there's no drawing the line with nutrients. There's already calls in Maryland by some of the industries to open up pollution trading beyond nutrients to other pollutants. So this is a slippery slope we're going down, and who knows where it ends. It's not good for waterways. It's not good for communities.
Well, we're going to take some deeper looks at this in the coming months, and look forward to everyone coming on for a roundtable on this, maybe try to have a town meeting on some of these issues and bring all parties to the table. Right now, I want to thank Scott Edwards, co-director of Food and Water Justice Project at Food and Water Watch, for joining us once again. Scott, thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Mark.
Good to talk to you. We're going to take a very brief break here on the Mark Steiner Show and here on Soundbites, and have a conversation with Tom Horton, who has been a commentator in this program for a long, long time, and Bill Nelson, about their journey for the last month with students around the Delmarva Peninsula, what they learned, what they've seen, and the changes Tom has seen over the last 40 and 50 years. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back here to Soundbites that you hear every week here on WEAFM 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on WSCL and WSDL, Delmarva Public Radio, every Wednesday as we talk about the future of our farming system. We are now about to talk to a man who's been a commentator here in Soundbites for a number of years, and it's always a pleasure to have him with us, Tom Horton, who is a professor of practice in environmental studies at Salisbury University, who covered the environment for the Baltimore Sun for over 35 years, and Dr. Bill Nelson, lecturer in environmental studies at Salisbury University, who have this very unique program with their students going around the Chesapeake Bay, and here to join us to talk about that and more. And Tom Horton and Bill Nelson, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be here, Mark.
Bill, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you, sir.
How are you doing?
Good. Glad to be on the air.
So, Tom, a little background here. I mean, so this is kind of interesting, especially from your perspective, having kind of covered the Chesapeake Bay and the Eastern Shore for the last 35 years or more, grown up there, son of the place, and now you're taking this journey with students. So describe this journey you're taking with these kids.
Well, it was kind of conceived a few years ago as, could we in about a month by kayak and van and camping give these guys exposure to a lot of the things that over my whole career had seemed neatest, coolest, most interesting, most important to know about the Delmarva environment. So Bill and I just put this together as a joint environmental education / learning to explore experiential education class, and we just finished it for the second time. We basically spend a month on the road and on the water and have a week back in class for the students to try and put it all together. What did it mean to them?
Bill, I'm curious from your perspective as someone who's kind of wandered from university to university now at Salisbury. what this course means for you as well?
Well, it actually means a number of things. most of my experience has actually been teaching middle school and then high school science, so the university setting is somewhat new to me. I've only been here for about 4 years. But basically, in addition to everything Tom said about looking specifically at Delmarva, I feel like these kinds of courses are great wherever you are for inculcating a real sense of place, seeing the landscapes that people work at, the diversity, as Tom said, but also the notion of being in the landscape itself and traveling through it under your own power. I think those are really fundamental, both in creating long-term memories and what some people call deep learning with students. It's basically they remember it. And it makes them feel more confident. And our hope is, honestly, that they won't just take this as a one-shot course where something happened to them, but they'll then use that as a stepping stone to go out and start exploring on their own. I think that's sort of the root of experiential education.
So, and it's such an exciting program. These are the kids that you, as you were saying to me, Tom, that you take out on kayak a week at a time,
yeah,
to points that most people never see or
yeah,
experience.
One of the interesting discussions we get into is the fact that a lot of what we see and where we camp and where we paddle is not that accessible to the average person. You know, Bill and I have a lot of contacts. We use the good offices of Salisbury University to get places. But the students are struck by how hard it would be for the average Joe to go do what we've done. And, of course, we talk to people like the Captain John Smith Trail organization, the Chesapeake Conservancy, which is working to improve public access. But, we need to make it much easier for people to do what we do.
Now, why is that? Why is it that people don't have access to the kind of places that you go to, whether it's the swamps in Greensboro, the Delaware Bay, the stuff you were talking about, watching the horseshoe crabs, which we get into? What's the underlying issue here?
Well, I think a lot of it is just in private property. There aren't there isn't public land, and I don't mean by that we need a lot of night lights and parking lots and big facilities. That would not be good. But I think the other part, Mark, is that there probably are more places than most people know, but there's. Not too much that really pulls all that together and makes it accessible to the average person who just says, I want to explore Chesapeake Bay, I want to explore wherever. How can I get there? What are some remote sites that I could access? So it's a combination of needing some modest property acquisition and modest facilities and perhaps publicizing what is there.
Let's talk about what is there. I mean, what kind of things you this the kind of stories that you came back with and the kind of places you've seen. I thought, you know, that there are a lot of people out here who are listening to this program, no matter where they are in the state of Maryland listening, that they love eating their oysters. They love eating their clams. And that's a world that has fundamentally changed in the last 50 years since you've been observing it, Tom, and that you both visited.
Yeah, and I don't know, Bill, what would your strongest impressions of that be from the last month?
You mean as far as places to see that what was special? One thing that immediately jumps to mind is a really accessible trip when we went out to Cedar Island, which, as you may know, was going to be the next ocean city. It's an hour's drive south of Salisbury. It's an hour's paddle. Anybody can do it. And you go out, and there's just miles and miles of undeveloped island and empty coastline. It's absolutely spectacular.
And the bay side or this ocean side?
It's the ocean side.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's the barrier island south of Chincoteague. And another is just about anywhere on the Nanticoke or Broad Creek. Again, it's, you know, it's just as far as Vienna, it's 45 minutes from Salisbury. And if you can find a place to put in, like Tom said, the riverside is beautiful. And as we were going down, Tom said it really hasn't changed much from when he was a kid, you know, the view that we see from the boat.
So if you can put in.
Yeah, and there are places. There are places.
Or if
you just have to look a little.
Paddle all day, you know. One of the things that we have seen change. I mean, we are more and more talking to oyster farmers and fish farmers and clam farmers instead of wild harvesting watermen. Although I have to say the real deal watermen still, like a cat fisherman we talked to on the upper bay, the Sassafras River, they capture the students' attentions like nothing else, you know. I don't think that's ever going to change. They just haven't met people like that actually go out there and make their living off the bay, never knowing what they're going to get from day to day.
So how was that? How, I mean, when you said that to me earlier today, I'm very curious about that. Let's stay for a minute with these with clams and oysters and catfish, because I mean, like many of us listening to this broadcast, I love my catfish.
Yeah.
But you're talking about watermen who have shifted from oyster harvesting to hunting wild catfish.
Yeah, I mean, some of these guys would have been catching probably more shad, more herring, more rockfish, more oysters back 30 years ago.
It's not there now.
You know, Mark, you're catfish eating isn't where their money lies, though. You know where they get the real money from?
Where's
the catfish? They sell them to people with tanker trucks that take them out to Oklahoma and Indiana and throw them in farm ponds and charge fish-starved people out there money to catch them. Isn't that amazing?
That's funny.
Yeah, and like snapping turtles. We talked to snapping turtles.
Let me tell Valerie to turn off the phone, turn off the radio right now.
No.
Oh, go ahead, Tom.
One of the big markets for snapping turtles is China. They're buying all the big female snapping turtles for turtle breeding farms in China. They fly them live to China from the bay.
People are still eating snapping turtles.
Apparently, and it must be a rich Chinese market because snapping turtles grow so slow. You're not going to feed a billion people with turtles.
I know when you see a gigantic snapper, you know it's been around a long, long time.
Oh yeah, they can live for decades.
So, but going back to the changes you've all seen, I'm curious about when both of you have seen these changes. When you go to, let's say, the Waterman, which was a fundamental institution in the state of Maryland, fishermen out there, as you said, rockfish, oysters, clams, shad, which you can't find anymore because they're depleted, and herring, which is difficult to find as well. This is how people made their living on the bay, and their stories and pictures of watermen, black and white, out in the bay making a living, and that's all. So what's the transition mean? What I'm curious what you both have seen in terms of these last 40, 50 years in people's lives and in what that means for the industries.
Well, a lot of them are farming now. You know, they're aquaculturing clams and oysters. They're still on the water, but in a much more organized, sedentary way. They're not going off every morning to see what they can find. They're going out to where they have their oysters or their clams planted and growing, and they're cleaning them off and putting them in bigger cages. And it's a, you know, it's a nice, sustainable industry, good for the economy, you know, keeps them on the water, but it's very different. It's the difference between agriculture and hunting, really.
And I think there's sort of two responses I'd have to that. One is from the customer's point of view, I don't think much has changed, because 50 years ago you walk into a fish store or the fish department of grocery store and you see a nice selection of seafood. You walk in today, you see the same thing. But as Tom said, the difference as to where it came from has changed dramatically. A lot more is cultivated here, and actually a lot more comes from overseas. And then from the waterman's point of view, I think what's changed is there's two things with them. One is that everybody we talked to was not an oysterman or a crabber or a snapping turtler. They did a whole bunch of different jobs, and as Tom said, oftentimes had land-based jobs as well to make ends meet. And then they also talked about the increasing regulation and how much more difficult it is for them to ply their trade.
So I'm curious, Bill, when you get the students back in the classroom, how do they wrestle with the experiential learning and what about the analysis that goes with this once you get back?
Well, that's a funny thing. I have a whole list of you know, what's difficult about it. And one of them is it's really difficult to evaluate. And basically what Tom and I do is we have them keep journals along the way. We have them give presentations and try and come up with all these, you know, sort of little milestones where we can evaluate them relatively objectively. But for their final project, we say, what did you get out of the trip? What does it mean to you? What stuck with you? And we leave it wide open, so kids can make a movie, they can make a PowerPoint, they can just, you know, they can go all over. And we try really hard to focus on their strengths and what they got, rather than did you get this point or that point. because it's a tidal wave of information and senses, basically, and experiences.
No pun intended.
No, it's true. They're getting way more than you could process. I mean, I'm trying to cram 40 years of stuff I found cool into 4 weeks. Impossible, of course. But they're getting more than they can process in a month.
Some of the places you went to, as we were talking earlier, Tom, that you can both talk about. I mean, you talked about going down. I guess it was the Sassafras with our old friend Wayne Gilchrist, former congressman from the Eastern Shore.
Yeah, that's a great way we start the trip with Wayne. Couldn't find a better start to the trip.
A teacher himself.
Yeah.
And he goes down there and they catch catfish and eat it together?
Oh, yeah, we'll do catfish. We try to do as much local food as we can, including snapping turtle meat, which 10 of the 11 ate it, and the other one made a really good try. we don't force that, of course, but we do crabs, we do oysters, we do clams. Wanted to do eel, which we also found some people selling eel. Again, the market is not here; it's in Asia and Europe. But we didn't get any eel for dinner.
So, Bill, I mean, what was eye opening for you? One of the things I know that Tom was saying that you all went through the swamps of Greensboro.
Yeah.
I think most people have not seen.
Yeah, the first time that I did this course with Tom, most of the places were new to me, which was amazing. And before this course, I would have said, well, yeah, I have a reasonably good understanding of Delmarva. But he, you know, as you know, Tom knows a lot of magic spots and
yes,
a lot of magic people. So that was really something else. And I just lost my train of thought.
I asked you originally about the swamps in Greensboro.
Well, you know, the thing is, Mark, most people say they know Delmarva, and what they know is the 1% around the edges, the beaches, the islands, the St. Michael's and Oxford, which is probably the coolest part of Delmarva. But then the other 99%, people just ride through it on their way to OC and see corn and soybeans and chicken houses. But the peninsula is also laced with these interior swamps and rivers, the Choptank, which starts up around Greensboro, the Nanticoke, which starts up above Federalsburg, the Pocomoke. And those are very seldom explored and visited, and they're very cool places botanically from a wildlife standpoint, just from the standpoint of staying cool on a hot summer day and kayaking down little tree-shaded upper river systems. You know, people, when they crossed the Choptank on Route 50 at Cambridge, couldn't conceive that 35 miles upstream are these beautiful little riverine swamps around Greensboro and Denton and Goldsboro. So we devote a week kind of to interior Delmarva, because that's the Delmarva that very few people know and explore.
So, go ahead, Bill. You were about to say something.
Yeah, and in addition to sort of trying to show them typical Delmarva, there's also, for instance, with Greensboro, we stayed with an old friend of Tom's, Nick Carter, who has taken what in the 60s was a failed farm and let it regrow into a forest. And so to a passersby, even a biologist, it's a nice piece of forest. But to walk that land with Nick and have him talk about the hydrology of the area and what he's done in sort of restoring a natural system and cycling of nutrients and everything, that was one of the high points of the trips for the kids. So it was, it's both the things that you and I might see if we were good about looking at a map and exploring, and also little corners that, you know, would be difficult to expose.
I tell my students that Nick has done with his land the very hardest thing for Americans to do.
What do you mean?
That is nothing. Stand back and let nature take its course. That is almost impossible for us to do, and we don't do it enough. So
why do you say that's important, Tom?
Well, because his land has gone from a pretty much a wasteland to a place that is abounding with wildlife, that is producing the very highest quality water. It's only 30 some acres, but what if more people did that? You know, what if it were 30-some thousand acres or 300-and-some thousand acres? We would have a much cleaner bay and a lot more wildlife. And, you know, so it's an important lesson. Doing, quote, nothing with land isn't doing nothing, because the land and nature are doing plenty. You're just letting them.
So I'm curious what both of you then, I mean, because as I was hearing about this trip, and it sounds like an incredible trip for students to be able to take, for anybody to be able to take, to open their eyes to the parts of existence that we do not see when you're living in an urban area, or when you're just speeding through on the way to any ocean spot or whatever. You don't really stop and see any of this or experience it. But I wonder what both your sense of the past and what the change you've seen, and what this and where this kind of course is taking you in terms of your idea about what the future is and could be. I mean, because of the changes you've seen.
Well, Tom and I might answer differently. I'm kind of schizophrenic about it, honestly, because we also, in the course of our travels, we talk a whole lot about environmental issues and environmental problems and all sorts of stressors, and Lord knows there's a lot here on the Eastern Shore. But on the other hand, there's not only an incredible amount of wild beauty left on the Eastern Shore, but there's an awful lot of protection and conservation and preservation that's going on. And we, you know, for instance, we talked with Russ Brinsfield, the mayor of Vienna, and Liz Drucker, the Nature Conservancy, about all of the efforts that are going on to preserve the Nanticoke. And it's almost a national model. There's all these different agencies working together, you know, to try to preserve the watershed. Down in the Nature Conservancy with the Virginia Barrier Islands, it's like 70 miles of wild shoreline that they preserved, and the coastal bays down there that are just phenomenally, you know, profuse with life. So there's a lot of hopeful things going on.
Tom?
Yeah, you know, to me, maybe the most important thing we teach is, Bill knows this because Bill's crisscrossed the country two or three times, 15 miles an hour or less on a bicycle. And
that's another story. we want to hear.
Moving through the landscape at bicycle, at walking, at kayak speed is just, I think we move too fast in life. We think it's all about how many miles we go, but it's how we go those miles. And I sometimes think, you know, when all's said and done 20 years from now, those students look back, that may be more important than any factoids Bill and I tried to cram into their heads. Not that that stops us from cramming factoids into their heads, but, you know, we got to justify our paychecks by just moving at a different pace through the landscape and preserving it.
I'm curious because this is kind of a brand new experience for students who go through these things and go, let's say, as you talked about, to the Delaware Bay counting horseshoe crabs, which people don't usually see, that I've had the pleasure and luck to see with people like Charlie Stein. But it's amazing when you see thousands of horseshoe crabs mating on the beach. It's something that's not something that's usually that people see as an amazing sight. But I'm curious what continually awes people like you, Tom Horton and Bill Nelson, who know this place. I mean, who tramped through the woods, who have, you know, kayaked down its rivers and canoed, who felt it and spend nights and camp out for days on end. What still brings awe to you in doing this?
Tom?
Bill?
For me, what immediately came to mind is, for instance, when we were kayaking down the islands of the bay and we kept coming across different shorebird rookeries, and just to see, you know, the birds out there sitting on their eggs, or the chicks running around, I don't know how to say it without sounding really corny, but the pageantry of nature, you know, I mean,
right? No, right.
The sunsets we saw, the horseshoe crabs were amazing because I, you know, every time you see it, it's just astonishing to you. And then furthermore, you know, some of the horseshoe crabs are tagging them now. And some of the crabs, one of them had a tag from New Jersey, and one of them had a tag from the Chesapeake Bay. And this was in the Delaware Bay. And it's like, how is that possible?
Wow. You know?
And then another aspect of it, well, the same night, we were asking the scientist who was working with us with the horseshoe crabs. And I was like, well, How deep do they live? We don't know. How far out do they go? We don't know. What's their range? We don't know. And it was basically, we don't know so much. You know, here we pride ourselves on how technological and scientific our culture is, but we're so ignorant when it comes to nature. It's humbling.
That wasn't corny at all. I mean, that's actually pretty profound, Bill, because I think that's true. We really don't know. And this is the more we kind of, as you said, you know, we could see the island where you paddle through could have been the next Ocean City, but it's not. Mm-hmm. That preserving some of this land or the forest you were talking about, Tom, and your friend, I mean, that's part of what we lose and not beginning to be able to explore what our real world's about because we just kind of plow it under.
Yeah. And Mark, when you talk about, you know, what the unspoken question, I guess, is sort of how can the average person get involved in this? One of the things that was humbling to me, and I'm sure Tom as well, was the generosity of fellow educators. We could not have done this trip without dozens and dozens of people offering their time, their services, their expertise, you know, places to stay, all sorts of things. And they do it so willingly, you know, and that's basically how education works. And if you're listening to this program and you're thinking, I'd like to get involved, just contact your local environmental organization. You know, the Delaware Coastal Base would love to have volunteers for their fish surveys and their horseshoe crab surveys. And the Nature Conservancy in Virginia puts out calls for volunteers to go out and harvest the eelgrass, which is a phenomenal experience in itself. You know, there's so many sort of citizens science opportunities that people can get involved in for free close by that are really rewarding and fun.
Tom, we have about less than a minute left in our segment. Closing thought.
You know, I mean, as much as I like the natural world, I think what fascinates me the most is those intersections of people with the natural world, whether it's biologists or watermen or farmers who are trying to grow food and pollute the water less. You know, people who are invested in the landscape, who are passionate about it. So, you know, from the aquaculturists to the scientists to the do-nothings like Nick Carter, who let his forest revert, to people like Wayne Gilchrist, who I dare say is happier out of Congress.
Yes, he is.
Taking kids out
yes,
in
he is.
Canoes. You know, that to me is just inspiring. And you know, we're the professors here, but you know, we get a lot of feedback, most of it positive, from our students. You know, just seeing these guys, you know, they weren't born yesterday, but they weren't born that long ago, so a lot of these experiences are so new to them and powerful. I think I
want to thank you both. Tom Horton, professor of practice in environmental studies at Salisbury University, who covered the environment for the Baltimore Sun for 35 years, and Bill Nelson, adjunct lecturer in environmental studies and program manager, internship coordinator, and green floor leader at Salisbury University. Thank you both so much for joining us for this half hour. It's been great.
Okay, Mark. Bye.
Appreciate it.
Good luck to the future of the Bay and to our students in learning about what we can do.
Thank you.
On the way out of here on Soundbites here on the Mark Steiner Show, I remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Mortgage late? Don't wait. If you're struggling with your mortgage, the state of Maryland is offering housing counseling and legal assistance. Maryland's HOPE program can even help you understand the state's mediation law and the Attorney General's National Foreclosure Settlement. Don't wait. Get help today. More information at mdhope.org or 877-462-7555. The Mark Steiner Show and Sound Bites is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Bobby Marvin Holmes, Mark Gunnery, and Stephanie Mavronis. Our interns are Lila Warshaw, Albert Phillips, Daniel Dupree, Alex Schutte, Sinead Hawkins, Kamani Seldon, and Michelle Zay. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews with Clean Cuts. Please visit SteinerShow.org to find out about our guests and the work that they do, and download all of our stuff on iTunes now and listen to it. And for public radio, to be EAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.